We already introduced ourselves when we run around the table. The one thing I neglected to mention about myself is I'm the founder of the Women Business Leaders Foundation, a network of 3,700 senior women in healthcare and women who sit on the boards of healthcare companies. And so if any of you have senior women in your organizations who would benefit, I know if we took a show of hands, we must have about 10 WBL women in this room. And so it's a great networking opportunity. All right. So why have MACRA? How many of you have already familiar with MACRA? Hopefully you know what the acronym stands for. Wait, let's show the hands. Come on, let's be honest. Okay, because I'd like to think that that's at least a start. MACRA, Bob's going to run through most of the content on the MACRA, I call it nuts and bolts. And then really the issue is how to make MACRA an asset to you. Because you guys hold both sets of keys to a great extent. I assume, show of hands, how many of you own or employ doctors or doctor groups? Everybody here? Okay. And if not, it's still a very interesting strategic opportunity here because our traditional, we call it the original Medicare program of 1965, which is when Medicare was enacted, finally has a way of paying doctors that is the kindergarten step of really trying to get the fee-for-service program have some of the bells and whistles of managed care. Okay, so we have a growing population of Medicare Advantage enrollment, and you hear a lot about it. Maybe it'll get as high as 40% soon. But even if it's 40% of the enrollees, what does that mean, everybody? 60% is how are they getting their Medicare? Hello? A la carte? How many of you have parents on Medicare right now? And how many of them are not in Medicare Advantage? Even my father in Cape Coral, Florida, has a shoebox of EOBs that I have to reconcile. No 1-800 number that he can call, no centralization, and he's comfortable with that. All right? So, but Medicare Advantage is growing. And it has different flavors. Your provider-sponsored Medicare Advantage plans are not the same as the freestandings. So it's all about choice and what choice means. So this is my favorite slide because it shows you in the old days, in fact, here in Chicago, I know there are people from the American Hospital Association. I've been at Epstein-Becker since 79. Okay, so in 81, there was a 17-page document on how to go to DRGs from cost reimbursement under Part A. That was the first bundle, and I came here to Chicago to help draft the legislation. That was bundling. That was having hospitals be at risk. They yelled and screamed that the CEOs of the hospitals can't control the ordering of services. Why put the CEO? They called them the bean counters. Why should the bean counters be in charge of controlling costs? The doctors order the services. Do you think Medicare cared? No. They put the CEOs of the hospitals in charge of managing the length of stay and making sure you can live within a DRG. So that's the original Medicare. On the other side, back in 1982, TEFRA was passed. It finally made risk contracting a more viable business alternative, which is what Medicare Advantage is now. I did one of the first Medicare risk contracts. So so what do? You outsource A and B benefits. You're totally at risk for everything. To some extent, that's easier than the middle column. And it was through the Affordable Care Act that we finally had a way for the healthcare pentagon in Security Boulevard. If you haven't been to the headquarters of Medicare, you need to go see it. And they finally had the opportunity to fool around with the provisions of the law, where they wouldn't have to go back to Congress and get amendments all the time in order to do something different than either original Medicare, where you're locked into the 1965 definitions, or totally outsourcing. And that's where I heard somebody talk about the comprehensive primary care physician alternative. We had ACOs with either just upside or downside. We have all different kinds of pay-for-performance. Okay, so MACRA was enacted 2015, and coming from Washington, D.C., you enact something, and it never starts until 2 or 3 years later, and Congress has the opportunity to stick their finger back into that law and maybe change it even before it's enacted. We had a final regulation that came out, and it was under the Obama administration in October that the reg came out. So we have a lot of things going on right now related to MACRA. Some will happen next year. Some will happen the year after that. But what I want to impress upon you, we have a new sheriff in town where I live. And it really makes a difference in the way an agency administers a statute. And there, the woman, you know, Molly from the AHA, she is correct. There are regulations that are onerous. And the Secretary Price in particular, I've already been to his office several times, they're looking for examples of final regulations that occurred under the Obama administration that create challenges. And not everyone in the real world comments. And we need help between the intersection of law, policy, and the real world. If something is not working, we need to hear about it. And then now we have an audience that we didn't have before that may be willing to amend a reg. So, the Affordable Care Act section that this comes from on demonstrations and the CMMI, that's going to stay as is. And MACRA, I can tell you, I even have a daughter on Capitol Hill, works for Steny Hoyer, proud mother, that they're not going to touch MACRA or it unwinds. It's like pulling a thread from a sweater. They don't want to touch MACRA, so we have to assume that it's going to go the way it is. But I think there will be some changes to the edges of the regulation to make it more comfortable for everyone to be able to implement this in a reasonable way. Either that or they're going to move some deadlines in order to make it more flexible. We already saw that between the proposed reg and the final reg. But I will tell you, the strategy of CMS is to draft a more onerous proposed reg all the time, see if they can push the envelope. And they wait for you guys to make the noise and file the comments to see. And then they come back with something that supposedly is more reasonable, although I wish the proposed reg in this regard would have been more lenient to begin with. Anyway, Bob's going to take us through the nooks and crannies of it, the quality program. And then I'll come back later on the strategy.
Hi, good morning, everyone. All right, so I did come to the meeting in April. I see a few faces that were sat through my presentation in April, but not too many. It was painful. When I stood up after lunch speaker, I used the line I often use when I got Dennis's rather cryptic introduction, which was, of all the introductions I've ever had, that was the most recent. And got a laugh. You know, it's meant to get a laugh, but didn't now. And so Dennis got back to me after my presentation, and he stood up and said, of all the presentations we've had since lunch, that was the best. I'm going to try to avoid too many quips, especially since we're being recorded. So I'm not going to go as deep as I did in April on the nuts and bolts of MACRA. I'm going to talk about some of it. What we want to do is we're going till noon, I think, give or take, maybe less, hopefully not more. But we're going to go into just to penetrate some of the layers of MACRA. But really the point of this session is to, because we have people representing both health plans and health systems, and this is about points of intersection, the idea is to get some discussion going amongst yourselves, which Lynn and I will facilitate, on what are the points of intersection, the ways that health systems and their affiliated health plans can work together to optimize outcomes under MACRA. Now, of course, the question you may ask is, well, you know, we were in managed care. You know, we're on that Medicare. Those of us who are in the health plan side, we're in managed care. So why expect us to have anything to do with MACRA, which has to do with fee-for-service Medicare? And the answer hopefully will be revealed as we go through this discussion. Are there any immediate comments, questions, suggestions?
Anything you want to make sure Bob covers?
Okay. If you don't want to talk about MACRA, I could tell you about Comprehensive Care Plus, MSSP, what have you. So this is kind of like the money slide with MACRA. You may have seen charts like this before coming from other sources, but the idea here is, you know, so MACRA was passed in 2015, and they said there are going to be changes to the way we do fee updates in Medicare. So to begin with, there's that base fee schedule update. And what they said was in 2017 and through 2019, the base fee schedule goes up 0.5% a year. Then for the next 5 years, 6 years really, 2020 through 2025, there is no update to the Medicare base fee schedule. Now, one thing that you may want to think about as health plans is, you know, since your Medicare Advantage benchmark rates are based on Medicare fees to some extent, you know, what is the implication of this for that benchmark setting, which is not so much a point of intersection between your health plan and your health system, but just a question of, you know, what is that base going to be? I mean, we do think our colleague Tom Hutchinson, who comes out of CMS, was responsible for Part C payment policy for many years there. He thinks that, in a way, Medicare Advantage, certainly relative to other segments of the market, is probably going to be the most stable of all opportunities in the next several years as the Affordable Care Act exchanges sort out, Medicaid managed care goes through some volatility, especially if Congress passes some variant of per capita caps. But, you know, you can expect those benchmarks to only go up a nominal amount, especially in light of that 0% update that's coming up. Then, at the end of 2025, the law says that in 2026, there's going to be two different inflators or indices. One that will apply to QPs, and what is a QP? A QP is mentioned down here as a qualifying participant. It's basically a provider who is participating in advanced alternative payment models to at least a minimum extent. But basically, we don't know. CMS's rules with regard to the implementation of MACRA actually don't say anything else about 2026 and beyond other than that. And so there's a lot of uncertainty, you know, if your planning horizon is as long as 10 years, which isn't for most of us, but there's a lot of uncertainty there. So the point is, they're saying we're going to give a 0.75% annual update to QPs starting in 2026, but only a 0.25% update in that time frame for non-QPs. So they're saying we want all providers in Medicare to be participating in alternative payment models. And in that respect, they mean all these things that CMMI is pushing forth, as well as things that health plans are doing outside of Medicare that, as long as they meet certain tests, will qualify as advanced alternative payment models. And that's going to be, I think, a very shifting kind of characterization over time, an opportunity for a lot of lobbying and arguing over what really qualifies. So, for instance, I have a situation. I live in Maryland. Maryland has this unique all-payer model for hospital payment. And what they're doing right now is they're trying to do a deal with CMS that says everything in Maryland, in effect, is an advanced alternative payment model. And the way that they're trying to do that is to say these hospitals that are subject to this thing called global budget revenue will be ultimately taking on risk for total cost of care, and their physicians will participate in that, and therefore their physicians will be in these alternative payment models. So they're trying to do a thing where with a stroke of a pen and an agreement with CMS, basically every physician in Maryland will qualify as a QP. There's talk of other states looking at these all-payer models. Pennsylvania has something cooking. Vermont has something cooking. This has been something, certainly at the end of the Obama administration, these all-payer models was very popular. We don't necessarily see the Trump administration moving in that direction. So that's the base. And then you have two tracks under MACRA, or what they're, you know, they've introduced this QPP terminology, the Quality Payment Program, so that's really the label that they're applying to it. And so there are two tracks. The first is the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, or MIPS for short. And what MIPS does is it says if you'll be measured, if you're not in this QP category, you're going to be measured based on how you report on a variety of things that I'll get into in a second. And depending on how you report and how you perform, you will get a plus or minus percentage on your fee schedule, on your fee payments, out of original Medicare. So, and it's a 2-year lag. So, the 4% that happens in 2019 is based on performance in 2017. The 5% that happens in 2020 is based on performance in 2018. So, there's always a 2-year lag where they measure in year one or year zero, and they pay according to the outputs of that measurement 2 years later. So it's a plus or minus 4% first year, then 5, then 7, then 9. And you see here that says that there's a three times scaling factor for top performers if award funds are available, and there's also an additional incentive for so-called exceptional performers, a pot of $500 million. Now, what's interesting about this is that these upgrades or downgrades to the fee schedule are meant to be budget neutral. So the awards are paid out of the penalties. And if there are no penalties, there are no awards, even if you do well. Why does that matter? You'd think, well, there's going to be plenty of people who don't do well. I mean, for example, look at what the report that just came out 2 days ago about the physician performance under the PQRS. More than half of physicians are getting penalized 2% simply, and something like 80% of that half that are getting penalized simply didn't bother to report. So passivity led to a 2% fee cut. Now PQRS is one of the things that's being folded in to create MIPS. So it doesn't go away, it just gets folded in along with some other things that I'll show you in a second. So there's a tremendous opportunity for the likes of yourselves to simply help providers to do at least the minimum. And in fact, CMS came out in the final rule in October, and Secretary Price, coming in February, has said that they want to make it easier on physicians. So they essentially, you only have to report a few things in 2017 not to get penalized. You might not get a bonus, but If you get penalized in 2019 based on 2017, it's simply because you weren't paying attention and you didn't fill in a simple report. And so I think it behooves you, especially the health system executives here who have employed physicians, if your physicians end up penalized in 2019, it's really almost you could almost say an act of gross negligence. Because it really isn't that hard to at least avoid the penalties. That 3x scaling factor is if it turns out that they have a lot of people penalized and not a lot of people to be awarded, then they'll multiply the awards in order to use up the available funds. But we're not foreseeing it that way. We're sort of foreseeing it the other way. And then that additional incentive that if you score above 70 on the scoring scale, there is a pot of $500 million, which isn't a budget-neutral thing. It's just a pot of $500 million that's available to award those exceptional performers. Probably, you know, basically will be in the top decile getting that. The alternative to MIPS is the alternative payment models track. and I'll talk about that. And that says you're exempt from MIPS. You don't have to do any of that complicated reporting if you're a qualifying participant. And the way that works is in year plus one, you'll get a bonus of 5% of whatever you billed Medicare fee-for-service in the prior year as a lump sum bonus. And it's not, it could be less than 5% in some cases, but that's what's available. And it's not meant to be budget neutral. So it is available regardless of what happens in terms of MIPS or other sort of penalty situations. That's the basics. Any questions? And there is something I'll talk about in a second called partial QPs. Any immediate questions before we go on? I know this is a little dense, and you're probably thinking, this really doesn't affect me in my day-to-day life, so why are we talking about this? Trust me, it's part of the, think about it, it's part of the air you're breathing right now, okay? Because if physicians are, anything that impacts physicians, and this does, except those few physicians who just don't take Medicare, is bound to impact you, because you're thinking in a way of a hydraulic system where if something gets pushed down or pushed up in one place, it has repercussions elsewhere.
Okay. Where do you feel like your organizations are in terms of knowledge, awareness, game plan, around what he talked? At a low end of its spectrum, high end, somewhere in the middle? Where do you feel like you're at?
Yeah, so we've been with UAB, and they've engaged Dixon Hughes on this project, and so we've been alongside them. I did have a question, though, so I feel like we're in the middle to answer your question, but so that MIPS incentive payment, that's going to be a bonus that's then paid. So we're an MA plan. That bonus would then be paid by CMS directly to them and not inside the fee schedule, or do they get a bump in their fee schedule?
It's a bump in the fee schedule. Under MIPS, it's a bump in the fee schedule.
So one of the things we've got to think about from an administration standpoint, right, is we're going to go from one fee schedule to lots of, well, whatever that
right.
is. Yeah. Two fee schedules, right?
Right.
And different rates.
And it can be, there's an option if you've got it, if it's measured, MIPS can be measured at both the NPI level, the individual practitioner, and at the TIN level, the group. And in a way, you can choose to report either way.
Right.
So, it could complicate your life if you're reporting at the individual physician level,
right.
Certainly.
Yeah. With UAB, they're going to do their tax ID level, which
right.
is great for us. That's easier.
Right.
I will tell you, some of you have managed care contracts that pay based on percentage of Medicare fee schedule. So you have to go back and read those contracts. And we've had that issue before with deficit reduction, and there was a whole issue of who eats the 2% of deficit reduction. Do you remember those days? But now we have to also be able to monitor the different fee schedules around that. So you may want to look at that. Just a show of hands, how many of you, is MACRA the responsibility of the system? Or is the health plan also doing outreach to their network providers to, at least through newsletters or something, get the word out? Anybody on the health plan side talking to their networks about MACRA? Yeah. At least in a newsletter, something. Yeah. And Terry, why do you do it?
Wait a
oh, sorry. The mic's over there. Go ahead.
So,
Drew.
I think that in our, it's the system medical group, it's one, but more so our bigger concern came because we are in a little bit of a remote area of Florida, the independent physicians.
Yeah.
So our medical group makes up 30% of our network. So what we've done is had town halls with our independents. We're building a website for them to give them macro information, trying to point them to consultants. Our bigger concern is we feel like we'll have our medical group through our CEO, and that they're taking responsibility to make sure that all the MACRA timelines are hit, and that the inflection points, it's the independents, because if we lose them or they decide to move out of the market or something, it's going to affect our ability to care for the community in multiple ways.
Accessibility.
In multiple ways, right.
And are they appreciating it, Drew?
Are
they coming to it? Is it making a difference?
It's... As you know, there's a lot of Medicare volume in Florida. I think a lot of the physicians say, I'll just put my head down and I'll see two more patients every 2 days, and that's what I'm going to do. So I think it's not there yet that they're going to, that as they have in the past, they'll make up for it by running on the treadmill faster.
Well, I will warn you, I mentioned earlier about deficit reduction coming up later this year with the debt ceiling and things. We're now at a 2% cut. It may end up being 4% plus the cuts they'll get here. Eventually, I think they have to fill out a form and, like, get into the program. Terry.
So our system chief quality officer has been really managing this issue for the medical group. But we also, we only have about a third of our membership with our own medical group. The rest of it is with a bunch of PHOs and IPAs. And with those groups, we have been doing reach out with them and our regular work with them. And some of those groups are at risk. So, you know, we help them in that regard. So it's a mixed bag across whether or not they're employed physicians in our medical group, whether they're involved in a PHO, whether they're IPA, or just individual contracted physicians for us.
But anything you can do to maximize their original fee-for-service reimbursement, it affects you by having them be a little more fiscally sound than they otherwise would be,
so
right?
It's interesting because one of our PHOs actually wanted to come off risk, and this has been a big topic of discussion with them about helping them see their way to staying on risk with us on the MA product.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So as I've said, what MIPS does is it takes three pre-existing pay-for-performance programs in fee-for-service Medicare and bundles them together, the PQRS that I just talked about, the value-based payment modifier, and the meaningful use of EHRs. So that is now all being measured this year and will impact payment starting in 2019. So who are the clinicians that are impacted by MIPS? They're actually about 1.35 million clinicians in the Medicare fee-for-service system. So it's physicians, it's nurse practitioners, et cetera. It's not just physicians. And they may add another group of clinicians starting in 2021. That's something to watch for. There are some providers who are exempt from MIPS, not just the QPs. There's the QPs. There's also those who are in their first year of Medicare participation, and then there are those that are below a low volume threshold measured either by billings or patients. So, you know, there may be a few, particularly new graduates coming on that will not be measured. But you know, when they come into your systems, you want to make sure that you are getting them ready to measure. So the way MIPS is scored will vary by year. So for the first year, again, 2019 being measured this year, notice that there's no orange slice in the first year. So the orange slice shows up in the second year, and that's cost, or what they call resource use. And it's a small, it's only 10% at the beginning, and then it grows to 30%. So they start with 60% of it being quality, which is the PQRS measures. And again, most of this is reporting. Much of it is self-attestation. It's not some CMS auditor coming in and going through charts. There's a strong influence in here to use certified EHR technology, both to actually deploy it in practice as well as to report through that. So, and there are extra points that given if you use CEHRT, so bear that in mind. There's this other category called, I'm going to talk just a little bit about these categories, but the resource use is cost of care for attributed beneficiaries, which is kind of tricky because, you know, how do you know who is responsible for a patient? So what they do with primary care providers is they look for, it's sort of like the way that they attribute lives in the MSSP program. They look for the preponderance of E&M codes being delivered by certain providers, and they attribute those patients to those providers. And then they'll look at the total cost of care of all services. And then for specialists, they will look at, they'll attribute based on They'll use a Medicare spending per beneficiary measure, which for those of you who live in a capitated world think that sounds like a per capita cost. It's not. It's an episode cost that starts when there's a hospitalization, and it starts 3 days before the hospitalization and ends 30 days after discharge. And they look at what the total Medicare outlays were for that, for the people in those episodes, and then they attribute that back to the specialists who did the trigger, who performed the service that triggered the definition of the episode. So, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but you get into some of these things. You'll have to get technical in order to figure out sort of how this all tracks. Clinical practice improvement is a vast list of things, of activities that providers are asked to do in order to increase care coordination, you name it, expanding access, even, you know, something like offering greater office hours or a telehealth modality for after hours access to a physician. Those are things that are considered clinical practice improvement, and there are literally hundreds of things in the clinical practice improvement pick list, so to speak, and it's your job to work with physicians to figure out which things that they will deal with in that. Advanced alternative payment models, these are things, there's a definition here. Now, as I'll show you in a minute, in the first 2 years, the only thing that qualifies is CMS-driven models. In later years, so-called other payer advanced alternative payment models will count, and that's where you'll come in for sure. So the definition of advanced alternative payment models is, as it shows up here, first, they have to take on more than nominal financial risk, they have to report quality measures, and they have to use certified EHR technology. So again, strong emphasis on that, on using EHRs in certain ways. And the way they define if risk is occurring is shown in the bottom half of the slide. There's a withhold of payment, and again, these are CMS models to begin with. So is a withhold of payment by CMS if, and there's a reduction in payment rates, or there's a reduction, or there's a payback to CMS if performance is not up to or better than the benchmark. So many, you know, think about Medicare Shared Savings ACOs. There's about 500 of them. Something like 480 of them are in track one. Track one doesn't count because there's no downside risk. Providers made a big fuss over that in seeing the proposed rule, and CMS didn't budge. What CMS did do was they said, we're going to create something called Track 1 Plus, which will kind of be a half-baked version of Track 3 with slightly less risk and slightly slightly less sharing opportunity. So for 2017, the top of the slide shows you what counts as an advanced alternative payment model. Nothing else counts. Nothing else you may be doing counts. It's got to be some of these things. In 2018, they add the Track 1 Plus. They add this new voluntary bundled payment thing and so forth. And then Vermont their ACO gets to count as well under their all-payer initiative. Now, the way that they measure more than nominal financial risk is based on either a revenue measure or a so-called benchmark, the benchmark being a total per capita cost of care. So, again, if you've got the revenue base is saying, you look at the total revenue that the APM entity gets from Medicare, and 8% of it has to be exposed to risk. The alternative is, you look at that total cost of care benchmark. So we give an example here. The revenue is $10 million, so $800,000 has to be at risk. The flip side could be that the benchmark for the population being served is $25 million, which includes, you know, not just the services of the APM entity itself, but all the other services that Medicare covers for that population. And then it's 3% of that group. And again, it's an either or. You can sort of pick which measure gets you over the threshold. practitioners have to have a certain size of their revenue or their patient population coming through the advanced APM in order to qualify, even if you're already in it. So in the first years, it's 25% of payments or 20% of patients, and then that grows to 2021 and beyond, 75% and 75% of payments and 50% of patients. There'll be a quiz, so please take good notes. So, you know, it is a pretty high bar to leap to become a QP, and in fact, CMS, you know, out of that 1.3 million clinicians that I mentioned earlier, CMS projects that in 2018, between 125,000 and 250,000 practitioners will be designated as QPs. So they're only looking at a roughly 10 to 20% of all providers showing up as QPs in the first couple of years. There is this thing, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but there's this thing called partial QP, which is, you know, a kind of a compromise that says, that goes back to these little pies, and I depicted it a little bit differently here. If you get below those thresholds that makes you a full QP, you can be a partial QP, and you get exempted from certain MIPS measures and other things like that. So there's really three categories when you think about it. There's the full MIPS, there's the full QP, and then there's the partial QP, which keeps you in MIPS but gives you some extra credit for and escaping some of the things that you would need to do in MIPS. And then we finally bring in other payer advanced alternative payment models, which would be your plans generally, okay? And this comes in, this is payment year 2021, meaning that starting in 2019, if providers are participating in non-Medicare arrangements that meet the test of significant share of revenue and risk, then they will also count. And you see that if you see in Medicare, in 2021, Medicare only, it can be at least 50% Medicare only, or you can be 50% all payer as long as at least 25% is Medicare. You still have to meet 25% Medicare. And then in 2023 and beyond, 75% all payer if at least 25% of that is Medicare. So that's the opportunity, that's the longer range opportunity for health plans such as yourselves to create those advanced alternative payment model alternatives. But you have to meet certain tests. Not everything, just because you're taking risk as a plan doesn't mean that you qualify as an advanced alternative payment model. If you turn around and pay fee for service to your providers and they're not meeting that more than nominal risk test, then it doesn't qualify as an advanced APM. So back to the comment earlier about our PHO doesn't, you know, they want to get out of the risk business. Well, then they're taking themselves out of the advanced alternative payment model category for 2019. And now you may decide that's okay. You know, the one of the things that everybody assumes is that the best place to be is in the advanced alternative payment model category. That may not be absolutely true. If you do well under MIPS, perhaps you'd be okay and you wouldn't have to sweat all that risk-taking. By the same token, remember that one of those first slides I showed, come 2026, the base rate goes up 0.75% for QPs, but only 0.25% for non-QPs, and that presumably goes on in perpetuity. So, you know, the compounding effect could mean that QPs are going to get paid a lot better in Medicare than the non-QPs. We can assume that politics being what it is, that come 2026, this will all start to look different, and those non-QPs will have gotten all kinds of exemptions and protections and so forth, so that won't really come true. But no one can really predict that.
It'll be just another version of SGR.
Right.
Which is what this is replacing.
You know, it's more work for lawyers and consultants. So I'm not going to read you all of these, but there are all those criteria. You've got them in the slide deck. So I'm going to let Lynn back up here for a bit, and we're going to talk about the discussion between...
We'll stay up, because we've already kind of touched this page, but this is the bottom line, which is...
Go that way.
I went the wrong way. There it is. So physicians paid better by Medicare fee-for-service is a good thing. We can all agree on that. But it is strategic, and you can't really force a physician to do something they don't want to do. So if you happen to employ the physicians, this is direct revenue to you. So it really is your responsibility to figure it out. If they happen to be independent physicians in the community, it at least provides less pressure that the physicians have with cost shifting, which is what they do. If Medicare and Medicaid are not viable payers for them, then there's more pressure on the commercial side for them to make up the difference. So it goes without saying. Some of you who are trying to get higher scores on HEDIS and MA, there are studies. My background was health economics before I even went to law school, about the echo effect of when you ask somebody behaviorally to do something for like 25% of their time, it ends up having the echo effect on the 75% of their time. They don't really practice medicine that differently. They may a little bit on the margins, but they found that in areas of the country where Medicare Advantage is very concentrated, that the rate of growth of Medicare fee-for-service is slower because they are practicing medicine differently than they would had they been in the wild, wild west fee-for-service of Medicare. So there's all types of advantages in making sure that you are a resource, and many of these physicians, even with their local medical societies and their national medical societies and even their subspecialties, it's really technically challenging for them. They don't have the infrastructure in the back office. I hate when they call it the back office, because it should be the front office, because it's that office that gets them in trouble. So this is really what we wanted to talk about. The rest of the slides really are, why should you care, and how to get you more active about it, how to build it out. How many of you already are bundled payments in hip and knees, like on the commercial side? Okay, so we actually represent the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons and the role that they play. That's not, and there's a really interesting alignment there to try and see to what extent the hip and knee area. If you've ever looked at Medicare expenditures, it's like $6 billion for hip and knees, and then the second largest is cardiac, and that's only at $3 billion, and there's nothing in between. And then it's down from there. So that's one of the reasons why I think you'll see a lot of creative stuff around hip and knees on the Medicare fee-for-service side, more so than you otherwise would, and then cardiac comes next. Also, on the horizon is the Medicare fee-for-service program on the diabetes initiative. Pretty soon, the YMCA and other places will be covered effective January 1. So that's another area not related to this topic, but these are examples where there's stuff going on the original Medicare program side that it's helpful for you to follow and to be more aligned with that, because it's quacking more like managed care than it ever did before. And
want to get to the discussion part. There are some things to think about. There are some pitfalls here. First of all, you're going to have to spend money to make these things work, and it may not, you may not necessarily get the ROI from doing it. So you have to think about, you have to kind of create a business case around the investments that you're going to make that are going to promote success in macro. But of course, those things should be tied to the same kinds of investments you're making to succeed in other parts of your business. If you believe, and I think most of the folks in this room, by virtue of being who you are, already believe that integrated care and bearing risk is the way of the future, that we're not going to really revert back to a world of fee-for-service predominating. But, you know, Lynn and I have been around enough decades to have seen it, you know, ebb and flow, where we thought it was going to be all managed care, and then it kind of went backwards and didn't do that. But even now, you know, the world of fee-for-service is definitely changing, even if it's not, you know, it's not going to be pure RVU-based compensation, even though as recently as yesterday, you know, I was, we have a private equity client that's looking at buying a very large medical group, and these guys are rocking and rolling in fee-for-service and don't see anything, any reason to be heavily into the risk business anytime soon. So you just never know.
I would mention, Molly, you had mentioned about how Medicaid may change politically. In all the noise you hear from Washington on health reform, I do believe that we are going to see a fundamental change in the relationship between the states and the federal government on Medicaid, more than we will see on the exchange side. Why do I mention that? Because if there's a cap on the federal promise of paying for Medicaid, then this kind of risk-taking by doctors is going to go on steroids. The same way, if there is a cap on the tax deductibility of our health insurance, which has been in and out of Congress for the last 40 years as a good idea, bad idea, Republican idea, Democrat idea, anything that's going to put a cap at the federal level on the federal government budget or in what is within the tax-free thing that we all enjoy, it's going to put this kind of pressure on physicians in particular to be more aligned on the cost side of what they order and more aligned on some type of payment methodology that makes them aligned with cost savings and good quality. It's just going to make this go faster.
Right. You know, yesterday a colleague, I'll get the question, so a colleague of ours contacted me and said, I've got a client, it's a 200-physician medical group in a certain state. They've been approached by the largest Medicaid managed care plan in the state to take full capitation, full risk under capitation at 80% of what they get, of what the plan gets from the state. And my heart started racing. I was like, there's so many reasons why this is not a good idea, not least of which is, you know, Lynn's point about what may happen at the federal level. So the way to make it a good idea is to make sure that you have a really ironclad contract that protects you against some of these exogenous things hitting you on the downside. Peter.
Do you have to lock in to a track, and will there be, you know, flow between doctors that aren't meeting the APM and they have to go back into the MIPS? And is there any expectation around that?
I think you're sort of measured every year based on the criteria that are in place in that year. So, yeah, you could be in MIPS one year and advanced APMs the next and then fall back into MIPS and so forth. One thing to think about, by the way, when you know, the composition of medical groups changes. You know, you have recruitment, you have retirements or transitions and so forth. In a way, you know, think about, well, on the plane out here yesterday, somehow I ended up watching a few minutes of Moneyball. So it reminded me that, you know, you've got to think about every physician is going to have a MIPS score of a sort, and that matters when you're recruiting them. If you've got a group with a high MIPS score and you're going to recruit a physician who's got a low MIPS score, that might bring down the average, and that could impact payment for the entire group, and vice versa. You want to be out there looking for physicians to recruit who either have high MIPS scores or have no MIPS scores, and you can hopefully, you know, those early practitioners or those small ones, and hopefully you can teach them the right way to behave so that you can make sure that your system gets a higher score. But, you know, that's going to be, in a way, I think, if this really takes hold, your MIPS score is going to be kind of like your college transcript. It's going to be some grade you got at some point in time, and you're going to carry it around with you for a long while. So let's get to kind of the last part of the discussion, which is, you know, between health plans and health systems, what is it that you can do? We've put a few thoughts on this slide, really just to tee up the discussion, and we want to hear from you all whether you think these are valid, whether you and your environments are doing things that are that are the same, that are different, better. You know, the first one we put up is, you know, the assumption is that health plans are already in the business of population health management. You know, the earlier the round robin around the room was interesting, because I heard a couple of you actually said this. You know, our job in the health plan now is to work with our health system to teach them what we do in the health plan for the population that's not fully in the capitated environment. Mm-hmm. And so you have all that, you have these tools and know-how. You know, are you actually deploying them to the best effect, or are they seen as not applicable? You know, there are so many health plans. I've been inside of them. You've probably been exposed to them, where the health plan is considered another line of business. It's located in some other office across town. It's viewed as a threat, not an integrated part of the system, and they really don't talk to each other, and they don't co-support one another. What are your experiences that relate to this? Anybody?
Did it already happen where some of the health plan staff are helping the system merely with their ACO on the upside? I mean, we already saw that happen. Show of hands, people are doing that anyway.
We have one nodding. We have one shaking.
So once they're doing that on the ACO side, you've already created that relationship. This is like an extra step to help physicians in the community do better at their regular fee-for-service at the same time you're helping them. And it's just informational, especially when you're a nonprofit. There is some type, you know, community education is permitted. So getting the information out, it's part of your community service to get the word out. So should we go
there? Any other thoughts? This is sort of a nonverbal group. Well, while you're thinking about your thoughts on that first point, let me go to the second point, which is because I work with lawyers, the word appropriate appears twice in one bullet point here.
Although you drafted it.
No, actually, one of the appropriates was added by one of our lawyers. The point being that we're talking about risk coding. So MIPS scores and all that will be risk-adjusted in the same way that Medicare Advantage risk scores work, mm-hmm. using the same HCC coding. And as we know, you know, there's this action by the federal government against United recently made some news that says that it's basically an upcoding accusation. And so that's why the word appropriate is in there twice, because we know that you're trying to optimize risk scores in your MA line of business. Otherwise, you know, it's the difference. It's the easier way to get revenue up versus you get your medical loss ratio in the right place is to get the revenue up by the appropriate risk scoring. But people can get carried away. So you can use your MA experience to teach risk scoring, which will matter now for all those physicians who really aren't that deep into MA.
Terry.
So, Bob, my plan has not done a great job of risk adjustment, but we have an all-out effort system-wide to figure out how we maximize to the best of our ability and within the law risk scores. So I have a question about, do you have any pieces of advice about how we walk up to that line and never over it? Are there any things you can put in place that help us, you know, get every penny we deserve, but not, you know, a cent more?
Well, this is not too flip of an answer, but I want you to meet our colleague Tom Hutchinson, who's like the risk scoring whiz. There's also John Gorman in the back of the room, who his firm does a lot of this work in support of health systems. And the answer is, in a way, you gotta, you know, for instance, if you look at the United action, what it showed when they look at emails that transpired was, and again, I'm not saying United did something wrong, I'm just saying what was brought out, that you see you know, lots of action that says when scores can go up, we're going to go up, but when the appropriateness tell us it should go down, it doesn't go down. Okay, it's kind of like when oil prices go up, they go up quickly. And when they go down, the price of the pump doesn't go down quite so fast. That would be a telltale indication that you know, you're biased in your system, you know. Another is simply that, you know, your average risk score is climbing at a precipitous pace. And, you know, underlying that is like something happening that you've done to make sure that that happens. So those are a couple of examples of ways that you might kind of get in trouble. But CMS is very being very aggressive about it. And, of course, going along with that now is the fact that they're moving from the RAPS methodology to the encounter data methodology, which everybody expects will yield lower scores.
And I would just mention, people sometimes are naive. They think that sending things into CMS is just paperwork because it's not a CMS 1500 form or it's not a cost report. But these are certifications. These are just like Medicare fee-for-service claims. And that's going to be true even for the doctors in the community when they fill out those forms to show they did quality things. And it can be a false claim. We're defending several companies, but even without a government investigation, you have to treat it with like internal audit. The compliance program has to come in on a regular basis and check the quality. Those of you who use vendors, I was mentioning to somebody else, right now several of the vendors have subpoenas. So you may not have been touched, but anytime you communicate with one of your vendors, the government may be seeing the emails from your plan, and that email is being produced to the Department of Justice. So, and that may eventually suck you in. So this is one of those enterprise risk things we were talking about this morning, which is it? It's a probability that if it happens, it's high risk because it has volume attributed and it has false claims, both criminal and civil. So if it isn't part of your work plan from a compliance program, an internal audit, then you're not spending your money where the high risks are.
So one of my observations is that as we moved to Epic, we lost coding efficiency and efficacy. And, you know, as we're trying to, like, write that, I mean, our scores should go up much faster than you might expect them to otherwise. And so have there been, you know, cases where that's been documented as the reason behind increasing risk scores and that's been acceptable?
I've had situations, not so much on the health risk assessment side, but on that side, but in the fee-for-service world, in evaluation and management coding, E&M, where one group buys another group, and overnight the scores are higher, and the Department of Justice is using data, big data, to look at the bell curves, and you pop out, and the more you can be proactive to document in your company why. Like, what did the due diligence say? What was it that you documented better? What were the educational sessions? Because with all due respect, the subpoena comes 5 years later. I have to go back and recreate history. So anything you can do to document at the front end that there is a legitimate business reason for the increase and to archive it in more than one place, including your legal counsel's department, so it can be found later, would be ideal. It also suggests the tone of the emails and how it's discussed in the company, that it's a legitimate upside. There's slang sometimes used. You know, they just say they're leaving money on the table, but if you're entitled to it. And then it does help from a risk management to use some type of outside person to come in and validate it. When you use your own in-house counsel, sometimes there's a little. You still have privilege, and I know it sounds self-serving. You have privilege, but because they're inside management, the government sometimes is cynical about that. So having somebody on the outside come in under privilege, or even supervising someone under privilege, gives it a sense of autonomy and credibility that you don't get by just doing it in-house.
Yeah, we have a non-trivial portion of our business is helping health plans sort of self-audit before the feds come in to make sure that they're...
But also to report to the board, to be able to report to compliance committee.
Comment in the back.
Not that UnitedHealthcare needs defending, but by the way, with a comment you made earlier about how is it that you're communicating it, I mean, my my statement always to everyone was never write anything that you don't want to read in the newspaper. But in United Healthcare's case in particular, the HCC model itself is designed to be it's designed to reset every year, as everyone knows. So the issue of when you identify codes that have not been documented through the normal claims flow, the data that comes through your normal claims flow, you identify in chart review and things like that, those codes that have not come through and you submit that as supplemental data, those codes get turned off at the end of the year, so they're no longer valid. United will have a great defense because they're simply following the process that CMS set up. The HCC model itself removes all codes every year until they reappear naturally or through normal data gathering to get appropriate payment. Right. So the biggest issue is exactly as you pointed out, it's how is it that you are describing it, because it is appropriate revenue that you ought to receive based on the true risk profile of the population. And it's not easy for that risk profile of the population, which has to be recreated every year come January 1st. So as far, I think that the industry shouldn't have tremendous trepidation. You mentioned earlier John Gorman is partners with a company, Pulsate, that does a lot of this. There are a lot of companies that help do this, and they have processes in place for the health plan inquiring. How do you make sure that you're getting the appropriate revenue and that it is optimized to match the risk profile of the population? So again, people shouldn't have the trepidation. Health plans should not have the trepidation about whether you're doing this, because those processes and outsourcers, they have programs in place to identify. I mean, that code, if there is an event that says this person no longer has this diagnosis, well, that even though it's documented, if it's documented in February, that diagnosis is no longer applicable. The payment isn't supposed to drop until the following year, because it was still applicable during a portion of that year.
Right.
Again, be careful about how you interact and how you depict your approach to managing your revenue, and not you don't have anything to apologize about with respect to programs that seek to optimize that.
Right, and I don't think we're arguing differently. But to bring that back into the context of this discussion. Those of you who represent health systems and don't live day-to-day in the health plan environment can understand why your health plan colleagues live and breathe this. If they're in Medicare Advantage, they're living and breathing this, and it's one of the top priorities of most health plan executives. And you may be sort of oblivious to it in the fee-for-service world, but now it is oozing over into the fee-for-service environment, and your health plan colleagues really have the know-how to help you master this.
If up to 40% of Medicare is going to be in Medicare Advantage, then there's going to be new legal theories of what is a false claim, and we either are going to be able to successfully defend it or not. Years ago, false claim was just labs and DME and home health and hospitals, and the next thing you know, off-label promotion came out, and they went after the plaintiffs. When it's not always the government, it's private parties who bring the action on behalf of the government. So next thing we know, off-label was causing a false claim so they could get to the pharmaceutical industry. Then it was the device industry on the hip and knees. And now it's much more front and center for both Medicare Advantage and to a lesser extent Medicaid managed care on the way in which they submit a claim in order and with a certification, and could there be a false claim? I'm not saying there is, but it's part of the virus that's going through that area now.
Okay, we're about out of time. Any last comments, questions, reaction?
We'll be at lunch. We're going to stay for lunch. We really appreciate being a sponsor and always love the Health Plan Alliance.
And we rely on your expertise to a great degree. So thank you, Bob and Lynn, very much. Thank you.
Good work this morning. But again, as we break for lunch, any other comments, questions? Where do you feel like you're at in this space? Additional things for us to do, John? Final quick comment.
Bob, I know there's a big movement in D.C. among several groups like CAPG and others to get Medicare Advantage risk contracts accepted as an APM. Can you speculate a little on its prospects?
Well, Medicare CMS has shown no inclination to let Medicare Advantage be allowed in as an advanced APM until 2019. They believe that that's essentially written into the statute, I think. And then it's really, and so I don't see, you know, there is a publication that CMS produced in, I think in about a month ago. I had a link to it in my slide deck from April. It talks about looking at Medicare Advantage as an option, as a possible advanced APM, but they basically concluded that there was no reason to rush it. So, you know, you could try to lobby that. But again, to one of the points I made earlier, just because you have a Medicare Advantage plan and it takes risk, it really doesn't qualify as an advanced APM to the providers unless it meets those three criteria.
We have the reason why they're reluctant is
The reason why politically it's difficult to do that for Medicare Advantage is because of the bundled payments. If they do it for Medicare Advantage, then what's the difference? Why can't the hip and knee doctors get the same advantage because their product is under a bundled payment, regardless of whether they themselves in their compensation is at risk? They want the physician's personal compensation to be at risk, to qualify, regardless of the doctor's relationship with whoever it is, basically.
Great question, John. Thank you.